Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tonight, the most prominent springtime meteor event is lighting up the sky. But do you know where to look? We'll have some tips from NASA. They're going to help point our eyes in the right direction. Plus, we're also going to spend some time talking about human rights and why genocide often goes unchecked. We'll explore California's dark history with our very own Native population and what's being done to right the wrongs of the past. Also this week, a major announcement is expected by the Biden administration on the Armenian genocide. It will be historic if it actually comes to fruition. We'll explain why this acknowledgement, even more than a century later, means so much to the Armenian American community. California is home to the largest Armenian population outside of their homeland. We'll also explain the potential political fallout with neighboring Turkey if this does take place. But first, we're going to continue to dive deeper into the significance of the Derek Chauvin guilty verdict. The killing of George Floyd may have been the tipping point. States across the country are now renewing action on police reform. President Biden himself also working on similar policies at the federal level. But here in California, a group of lawmakers led by African-American lawmakers are working to pass their own bills. Joining us to talk about the latest efforts at the state capitol is Cap Radio's state politics reporter and co-host of the California State of Mind podcast, our very own Nicole Nixon. Welcome back to Insight.
Hey, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
You know, Nicole, just getting a look at this, there are several bills, I think seven by my count, that we're going to dive into. But can we talk about the significance of these bills, the energy leading to this ramp up? Because this isn't the first time or the first legislative session that these have been attempted. What can you kind of pinpoint the moment or the time of when the energy behind these bills, the political will, began to ramp up?
Yeah, you know, last year marked sort of a turning point on police reform issues nationwide. But I think California lawmakers really started looking at this a couple years ago, a few years ago after the police shooting of Stephon Clark here in Sacramento. He was killed in 2018. Within a year, lawmakers had introduced a bill to raise the standard for when police can use deadly force. It was signed into law later that year in 2019. And this is still being pointed to as an example of change that can happen after these killings. And it is still celebrated because everybody, even police unions, got on board and supported this. So after the death of George Floyd last year, obviously, we had nationwide protests, calls for more police accountability, state legislatures across the country introducing new police reform bills, including here in California. A few of those bills did pass last year, a couple that would provide more oversight for county sheriff's departments. They banned the carotid hold. The bigger, I think, more sweeping bills being pushed by black members of the California legislature did not pass. So here we are again this year with many of these bills and a few new ones.
Yeah. And with that said, I mean, looking at some of these bills, most of them are in the state assembly. I mean, this could potentially change the education requirements or the age to become a police officer. It would strengthen criteria to strip police badges from bad acting officers and even bar police departments from investigating incidents of deadly force within their own departments. And those are just a few. But you also mentioned, I mean, there were some bills last year, or one in particular, that's being reintroduced because it was actually vetoed by Governor Gavin Newsom. So what are the chances of these bills actually going to the finish line and actually getting a signature?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, last summer, this was an issue everybody was paying attention to. There were still protests going on, you know, in August when the legislative session was wrapping up. But inside the legislature, the COVID response really took up a lot of the oxygen. The session was cut short twice. It was virtual, half virtual near the end because there was a lawmaker that tested positive. So lawmakers spent a lot of time at the end of the session focusing on things like eviction protections. The clock really ran out before some of these other policing bills came up for debate. But the California Legislative Black Caucus is really trying to keep that momentum going. I think that the Chauvin verdict adds some momentum for them. But they are really ramping up their pressure on their colleagues in the legislature and the governor to support their bills this year. Here is Senator Stephen Bradford. He chairs the Black Caucus. They held an event earlier this week.
The time is now for us to act. No more kneeling and social media posts. We've had enough of the performative acts.
And then he's putting them on notice to support these. I'll just play one more clip from Secretary of State Shirley Weber. She was also at this event because she's still a member of the Black Caucus, and she chaired it until recently when she left the legislature. And she talked a lot about how Black people, Black lawmakers here in California and across the country have been talking about these issues for years. And basically saying that the rest of California's legislature needs to step up and support them. So here's Shirley Weber.
And as I've said to my colleagues across the nation, we have done as African Americans all we can do. We will continue to write legislation. We will continue to raise the issue. It is now up to the rest of America to decide if they want a better America.
Right. And I think what was so striking in the previous soundbite with Mr. Bradford was going beyond performative acts, talking about no more kneeling. And that's addressing Colin Kaepernick and also wanting to act in the form of policy and getting bills passed and signed into law. There's several bills that are being introduced by these legislators. Which ones are the top priority?
So it is, the top priority is Senator Bradford's bill to create this path to decertify police. California is only one of four or five states that doesn't have this currently. And this was like the bill that did not make it out of the legislature last year that upset advocates for police reform. Basically what this would do is allow the state to strip the badges from police officers that are convicted of higher level crimes or found to have done misconduct or abuse of power. It would also end qualified immunity for police in certain situations, which is another really big police reform that many people are pushing for right now. The police unions did oppose this last year, I think, especially with this provision to end qualified immunity. That will be a big battle for sure. There are a couple other bills that are coming back this year, though. One is being called the George Floyd Law because it would require police to intervene if they witness another officer using inappropriate excessive force. And it would protect officers who do report that inappropriate excessive force to their police chief, protect them from retaliation. This one is interesting because it was held back in a committee sort of without explanation last year. The bill author didn't even really know what happened to it. And then one more back this year that I'll just mention quickly is called the Crises Act. It would create pilots for more community-based organizations to respond to 911 calls rather than police. This is the one you mentioned that passed but was vetoed. And the author says it was vetoed sort of over a disagreement about where to house the program. She wanted to put it in the Office of Emergency Services. I guess the governor didn't like that. So now they're talking about putting it in the Department of Social Services. And she is more optimistic about it this time, too.
All right. And then there is data, and even police departments themselves and local law enforcement agencies have said that the growing number of 911 calls are for nonviolent, non-criminal issues. So it seems like what you're saying is that it was more of a logistical veto. It wasn't that the governor was necessarily against investing in community-based organizations to respond to these 911 calls.
Right. That's what she seemed to think. I mean, obviously, some of these conversations happened behind closed doors, and the governor didn't send any sort of letter when he vetoed it. But yeah, and the governor also has talked about how, you know, the amount of responsibility we're putting on police these days, they're I think something he said last year was that they're basically trained to be police and social workers, which he feels is inappropriate.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio's state politics reporter and co-host of California State of Mind podcast, Nicole Nixon, on a package of police reform bills currently underway at the state capitol. You know, you briefly touched upon police unions and how the last legislative session there were some bills that they were concerned with or opposed. Has their view changed over the past year, particularly with the trial of Derek Chauvin and the conviction of him in the death and murder of George Floyd?
Yeah, that's something I think we'll have to see how that plays out and which bills police unions decide to spend energy opposing or working with lawmakers to, you know, fine-tune so that they can feel they can get on board with. I will say this, the statements I got from police unions after the verdict were pretty surprising in how far they sort of distanced themselves from Derek Chauvin and said, you know, this was absolutely an example of an officer that was not following training. The Peace Officers Research Association of California is the largest police union. Their president put out a statement saying that they it is time to do like a national standard for use of force and better training for police officers. So it sounds like they would be supportive of some of these measures. There are others, though, that I don't see them supporting. But again, we'll have to see.
Mm. How could the recall election impact Governor Newsom's decision to sign any of these bills if they actually get to his desk?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's something that I asked these lawmakers, and they're hoping that it won't. They say that, you know, this is an issue that the governor has been strong on in the past, and he can continue to do that even with the recall. I'll also just point out here that the Governor Newsom is very popular among California's Black voters. A recent poll found that 70% of Black voters would not support the recall, that they would vote to keep him in office. Hmm. So that's a constituency that definitely would want to pay attention to.
And I know that you will be watching that very closely. And for for listeners that really want a breakdown of these pieces of legislation when it comes to police reform, Nicole has a great article up on capradio.org breaking down 7 pieces of legislation that are currently making their way through the state capitol. But Nicole, you're also the co-host of the podcast California State of Mind. Can you tell us and listeners what's coming up this week?
Yeah, we will have a conversation very similar to this about, you know, the verdict and the reverberations that it might feel in California, talking about some of these bills again. And it's Earth Day, so we also have a very interesting segment about some of the ways that California is trying to tackle climate change in sort of new and innovative ways.
Cap Radio's Nicole Nixon, thank you so much for joining us again. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Vicky.
Promises made, promises kept. Up next on Insight, President Biden made a campaign promise to be the first president to officially recognize the Armenian genocide. Why is this issue so important to so many? And why now? A conversation next about human rights and the importance of recognition more than a century later. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Human rights, it is a big topic. It is filled with emotion, hurt, pain, and suffering. It's also an opportunity to make sure the wrongs of the past are not repeated in the future, and acknowledging that everyone has a right to live in peace, no matter who they are or where they're from. Human rights can be violated, and they can also be restored, but that takes a lot of courage and will. Far too often, we have seen the evidence that even in a modern society that we live in, too many people are suffering at the hands of others, and acknowledging and shining a spotlight on those who have committed the atrocity of violating someone else's human rights is the first step in ensuring it doesn't happen again. Genocide is one of them. Joining us to talk about this issue is Dr. Keith David Wantonpau. He is professor as well as the founding director of the Human Rights Studies at UC Davis. Thank you for joining us and welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Vicky. And it's been so wonderful having you as part of our mornings just for the last 3 or 4 weeks now. So It's great.
It's a pleasure to be part of them. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, and thank you for joining us on this topic because it is Genocide Awareness Month, the month of April. Mm-hmm. Can you first explain exactly how is genocide defined?
Well, genocide is defined by an international treaty called the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide, which was passed in 1948 in the wake of the Holocaust, but also informed by previous genocides, including that of the Armenians in 1915. It was championed by Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jewish jurist who lost most of his family during the Holocaust. And the United States was a great supporter of it, as were other countries around the world. And it's defined as the attempt to destroy, in whole or in part, a people defined either as an ethnicity or a race or a religion, to destroy them. And this could be in terms of mass killing, which is the most popular understanding of genocide, but also a destruction of culture, mental harm, conditions which could lead to their destruction, and the transfer of children, the moving of children from one group to another. As I tell my students, genocide is an attempt by a state to erase a people and to make it as though they never existed by taking their land, by taking their wealth, by killing them, by taking their children, then erasing their history and denying that they ever faced genocide afterwards. So I often see genocide is defined as the crime of crimes. And this is why we set aside April, a month in which three of the most important, all genocides are important, but three of the most important genocides of the 20th century, the Holocaust, the Armenian genocide, and the Rwandan genocide, are officially commemorated. So we set aside this month as a way to remember, but also to explore ways to prevent in the future.
I think what is surprising when discussing the topic of genocide, I mean, there is an awareness of it. We all are aware. However, I don't think we have as much in-depth knowledge about unacknowledged genocides and why that actually happens. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, one of the truths of genocide is that they're always denied, that that someone somewhere will always deny a genocide. And the state of California, for example, in the last 2 years has tried to begin to address that by acknowledging the fact that California was a site of genocide. The missions were a site of genocide. The gold fields were a site of genocide. The residential schools that were set up to try to take from indigenous Californians their culture, their language, these were sites of genocide in our state. And also the state would sponsor efforts to exterminate indigenous people. And we've seen in California just in the last couple of years an effort to acknowledge that fact, to recognize that genocide is taking place in California, and then begin to move through a truth and healing council that's been established by the state of California to address that history, to recognize, address, begin to heal. And so this is why identifying and acknowledging genocides are important, because without that acknowledgement, the process of achieving justice and healing cannot begin.
You mentioned that when it comes to acknowledging genocide, sacrifices need to be made, and there are certain geopolitical or just political consequences. Can you kind of explain those sacrifices and consequences that need to be made to acknowledge genocide?
Well, I think the issue here is, the most important issue here right now is that the United States government is on the verge of doing something it should have done 50 years ago, right? So for my entire adult career as a professor, even as an undergraduate, I've followed the situation where political candidates would reach out to the Armenian American community. And they'd say, vote for me and I will recognize the Armenian genocide. And just a side note, what was the Armenian genocide? In 1915, the Ottoman Empire sought to destroy its largest ethnic and religious minority, the Armenian community that had been woven into the warp and weft of Ottoman society. The Ottoman Empire became the state of Turkey. And we recognize this month the day that the genocide began. And ever since then, the government of Turkey has said, oh, it didn't happen. It just didn't happen the way you said it happened. You know, the Armenians were rebelling and we had to discipline. Or, you know, the numbers are inflated. But in the last over the last 50 years, Armenian Americans have asked for the U.S. government on their behalf to recognize that this had happened, to say to the world that what had happened to them, to their ancestors, happened, as a way to begin the process of continuing to rebuild their communities, but also to begin to think about how we can prevent genocide in the future. So this is what's slated to happen this weekend on April 24th, which is Armenian Genocide Memorial Day. President Biden has sort of let it be known that he will be issuing a statement recognizing the Armenian Genocide. And the possible cost to that, I'd like to talk about some of the advantages of that in a second, but to answer your question, the possible cost of that is that Turkey, which has continued to deny that genocide, has made it very clear that if the United States recognizes the Armenian Genocide, that it may take actions which are against the interests of the United States. This includes perhaps making it very difficult for the United States to send ships into the Black Sea to help our Ukrainian allies who are facing a terrible threat from Russia at the moment. It could mean that Turkey could block our efforts to bring humanitarian assistance to the people of Syria who are suffering a 10-year civil war. It could mean that Turkey could block access to NATO facilities. Turkey's a NATO ally. So it could also mean that Turkey will continue the blockade of neighboring Armenia, which has been extremely costly and has helped create additional misery for the people of Armenia. But the United States, and I think those are real possible sacrifices and costs. But on the other hand, what this recognition will do, and I'm thinking about three things it will do off the top of my head. First and foremost, it aligns U.S. foreign policy with our values. The Armenian Genocide happened, right? We should recognize it, right? Even if it does come at these possible strategic costs. And I think that this is important because the United States, under the previous administration, had abandoned altogether its important leadership role in promoting and protecting human rights around the world. And with this act and others, Joe Biden is signaling that America's back, that we will bear the burden of protecting and promoting human rights.
And it wasn't just the previous administration, but really U.S. presidents past and present. You know, they'll acknowledge a mass killing that took place, but they don't use the term genocide. What has changed in the political will over several presidencies to actually lead to President Biden indicating that he's actually going to use the term genocide when it comes to the Armenian genocide?
I think part of it is this broader, we've seen as a people what happens when we let misinformation or disinformation get in the way. And I think that President Biden has said, no, it's what's happened. We need to acknowledge it. There's also, I think, a great deal of pressure from within his administration, primarily Samantha Power, who is one of the world's experts on genocide, who's also now a former UN ambassador, who, when she was UN ambassador, did not recognize the genocide, but now as director of the U.S. Agency for International Development will promote it. I think there's also this concern that if the United States does not take this stand, that its credibility in criticizing other states that are committing genocide will begin to erode. So one of the most critical things about recognizing the Armenian Genocide at this moment is that it's an attempt to signal to the world that impunity for crimes like genocide will not go unanswered. Mm-hmm. That impunity, which is the when a state feels like it can act without having any responsibility, it can kill, it can murder, it can take place. And for Armenians in particular, this recognition comes on the heels of a terrible and brutal war that its neighbor Azerbaijan brought to Armenia. The Armenians were defeated. They felt like the world stood by and did nothing. And Turkey was one of the chief allies of Azerbaijan in this war. And in fact, in Turkey and Azerbaijan, there are large numbers of people, including political leaders, who celebrate the extermination of the Armenians in 1915 and see what they're doing now as a continuation of that process. So this is, I think this is a very critical moment for the United States. It's more important than I think we will, its importance will reveal itself with time, because the United States is I think also within the next couple of weeks going to issue some fairly strong statements about genocide in China. Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get to that in just a moment. Right. When it comes to Armenia, does geography play a role in the challenges of, I mean, because you're talking about war that is ongoing in Armenia. Armenia mm-hmm. is surrounded by Georgia, Turkey, Iran, and Azerbaijan, though essentially it's landlocked. Does that play a role in what's happening as well?
To some extent, I think that what's really important here is that the United States under the previous administration made tremendous signals that it was going to be supportive of Armenia in the face of the war. But this recognition, I think, is part of rebuilding that relationship to make a stronger statement that we respect the integrity and the survival of the Armenian people. And the United States has played an important role in the history of the Armenian people since the genocide of 1915. The United States was one of the only countries that stood by the Armenians in the wake of the genocide. And, you know, the U.S. is, and California in particular, has been an important site of refuge for Armenians.
Well, California is home to the largest Armenian community outside of its homeland. Los Angeles and the Bay Area have the largest concentrations. I'm from Los Angeles. I live right by Glendale. It has a huge, substantial Armenian community, and it's a beautiful thing. What would a Biden acknowledgement, a U.S. president's acknowledgement, mean to the Armenian-American community here in California, since we do have the largest population?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I read the New York Times article, my reaction was different than I anticipated. My wife is Armenian, my children are Armenian, I'm part of the larger extended Armenian community. In a way. And for years, I didn't think that acknowledgement was going to be as was creating an emotional reaction that it did. Right? I mean, I could see the geopolitical reasons and the importance for history and so on. But when I read it, I felt overwhelmed. And in fact, I feel a little overwhelmed right now talking about it, right? It's as though a great weight has been lifted. To have the most powerful country in the world acknowledge the harm that happened to your ancestors, it's so important. And it's so important for the Armenian people.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Keith David Wantonpau about Genocide Awareness Month. It's the month of April. He's the professor and director of human rights studies at UC Davis. I was reading an article or an essay that you wrote last week. It was on UC Davis's website. And you said that you began to teach this course about 20 years ago in the aftermath of what you thought would be the last genocides. That would be Bosnia and Rwanda. You followed that up with saying that you're wrong. And you briefly talked about the Uyghurs, Muslims followed in China and what's taking place there. Can you kind of elaborate in that 20-year journey of teaching and research being wrong about something that you were very hopeful of, that genocides would come to an end?
Those of us in the field of human rights studies, we're eternal optimists, right? Even though we have to be, because we're surrounded by such terrible things all the time. We really believe that what was happening was because the United States finally, after 40 years of resisting approving the Genocide Convention, which it did for reasons of domestic issues around race and race hatred and Jim Crow and the fear that the U.S. would come under additional scrutiny because of racial terrorism in the American South, that there was now an international criminal court that would try and prosecute people who committed genocide, that the world really seemed to be united in its effort to prevent genocide. And that eroded so quickly, not only because of the wars that the United States fought and its lack of credibility in the human rights space, but also because the states that began to practice genocide either were willing to, were immune to some extent to international criticism and pressure. And I think that that is really the case for China in its effort to erase the Uyghur people, a large racial and ethnic minority in the far west of China that are seen as being antagonistic to the Chinese view of itself. And China's, and this is important to understand, is that China isn't necessarily murdering large numbers of Uyghur. They're being rounded up, put in camps. Men and women are being separated. Births are being prevented. Children are being transferred. People are being enslaved, and dissidents are being murdered. So, what I'm hoping that will happen this weekend, with the U.S. acknowledgement of genocide and this broader reckoning that we're going through as a society, in which human rights abuse is no longer acceptable, right? This is not acceptable to us as a people, that we'll be willing to take some of the measures necessary to confront China over the next several years to end the genocide of the Uyghur, and to try to bring China back into the community of nations where human rights are, the respect of human rights is expected of a great power like China. And this may require sacrifice on our part, because China is a major economic power. At UC Davis, we have very deep and important connections with China.
And you raise an ethical dilemma with that.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because our connection with China is very important to us. But in the past, when the University of California has recognized that genocide is taking place in other places, and Sudan is perhaps the most important example in the 2000s, we pulled our investments out of companies doing business in Sudan. And that was easy for Sudan. That's a much more difficult thing for China. And so we have to ask ourselves, what are we willing to do? What sacrifices are we willing to make sure that that genocide doesn't happen again, and to end genocides that are taking place now?
Yeah. And that's a great point, that if you want to address human rights issues that are taking place in the present, you also have to acknowledge the ones that happened in the past. And in your essay, you also brought up that your students increasingly want to learn more about genocide that took place in California. Can you expand upon that, as well as what types of recognition, even restitution, that can happen in our state?
Well, I think that's a really important question. And I also want to make sure that your listeners know I don't speak for California's Native community in this. But as an outside observer, as a historian, apology is important. Recognition is important. But in California, restitution is also going to be important. And so just as we think about how in our curriculum, in our schools, we integrate better the stories of Native Americans and other historically oppressed people in our state, we have to think about other issues where Native Californians, Indigenous Californians' basic human rights have been violated through, say, land use policy. And here I'm thinking about the Klamath River Basin and the allocation of water resources in particular, through the recognition of unrecognized California Indian communities, through the preservation and protection of holy sites throughout the state that are often very vulnerable to development, especially as we need more housing. Do we do it in a way that violates the cultural rights of Indigenous people? So apology is important, but so is action. And that's what we're hoping for this weekend, is the connection between acknowledgement and action.
I know that there's an indication that President Biden is going to acknowledge Armenian genocide. However, on the flip side, if that doesn't happen, what are the ramifications of that?
I don't want to speculate. I'm fairly sure that this is going to happen. What I'm more looking towards is what the United States and its allies are planning to say about genocide in China.
Dr. Keith David Wantonpao, Professor and Director of Human Rights Studies at UC Davis, thank you so much for your time and expertise and just passion on this important topic.
Thank you, Vicky, and goodbye.
Still ahead, there is a meteor shower taking place over our skies this week. Our next guest will tell us where to look and when, and we'll also talk about the latest with the Mars rover. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. STEM, it's an important acronym. It stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. And we're going to stick with UC Davis, but we're going to move over to a program that's helping underserved students who are interested in STEM. The program is called SMASH. It's 100% free. Now, the summer SMASH program is technically full, but we are told there's actually a wait list going on, and the program is currently looking for teachers. So there's still an opportunity to participate. Joining us to tell us more about this program, which started only a few years ago, is Alicia Puree, Regional Program Director of West Coast for SMASH. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
This is just such an interesting program and academy. And also, this is an acronym as well, correct? SMASH. Can you explain that a little bit more and break it down?
Yeah, actually, so we are moving a little bit away from the acronym now, but originally it was the Summer Math and Science Honors Academy, which it was because we really were only a summer program back when we started in 2004, and now we've really built out our program to be even beyond summer. So what we do is we are this free national STEM program. We seek to help underrepresented students of color access college and careers in STEM. And we're also really trying to build that next kind of socially conscious STEM workforce. So we do that by starting with high school students after their ninth grade. We're at 10 different university sites across the country, including UC Davis. And so we're so happy to be here in the Sacramento area at that campus. We started that program in 2016. So what we do at our SMASH Davis site is our high school students in non-COVID times would spend 5 weeks on the college campus, living in the dorms, feeling like a college student, but also taking these courses in STEM to really help them build their own STEM identities and access those kind of rigorous academic courses that they'll be finding in college.
Is there a certain group or demographic of students that you're gearing SMASH for? And if you can also touch upon the overall mission of the SMASH Academy.
Definitely. Yeah, so we do focus on students that are underrepresented in STEM. So that is typically people of color, specifically really Black, African-American, Latinx scholars, but also Southeast Asian. We also target low income, first in their families to go to college. We're really looking to, you know, change what that tech workforce looks like, what the STEM workforce currently looks like, and making sure we're providing that access. We're filling in those gaps that they might not be getting, right? That maybe that exposure to STEM that they might not be getting at their school or even in their families. So that's really our mission, is to build that workforce, to make sure we're eliminating any barriers that students have to access STEM majors and STEM careers.
Well, this year is going to be a little different because of the pandemic and COVID. Can you explain what students will experience this summer?
Yeah. So this summer, as well as last summer, we had to quickly pivot to a virtual program. And it was definitely a huge feat. You know, typically our students are spending a lot of time in the dorms. That's like part of the whole experience SMASH. So now to go to a completely virtual program was a big challenge. But I think, you know, we did an amazing job last summer, and we're really ramping up to do that again this summer. So the way we've pivoted is it's completely virtual, where students come in and they continue those STEM courses. We changed our class sizes to be very small in the virtual environment. We know that engagement is much higher when you have those small classes. So it's a 5-to-1 ratio, one teacher for every 5 students in the virtual environment. And then they're in groups working on solving problems that they're seeing in their communities and finding a solution using STEM. So for example, some groups last summer created an app that helped communities of color find and access COVID-19 testing, understand statistics around the differences that their communities were facing compared to other communities. Other groups were helping teachers think about how to make the virtual environment engaging for elementary school students. So really continuing that group, those group projects, focus on STEM, but doing it, all completely virtually. And so we'll be doing that again this summer as well.
Finally, we mentioned at the top of this that there's a wait list. So how can people who are interested get in touch with you? And also, you're also looking for teachers. So if teachers are interested in becoming a program leader, how do they get in touch with you as well?
Yes, thank you. So we did just close our application for our ninth graders. Typically every year we go ahead and recruit ninth graders to join our program. So if you're currently an eighth grader, think about us in the fall of your ninth grade year. Make sure you go to smash.org to access our application. And yes, we all will probably have a wait list for our ninth graders. So again, you can go to smash.org and find all our contact information there. We're also actively right now looking for teachers or just folks that want to work with our young people, especially for our UC Davis site. So if you're a teacher, an educator, grad student, and you want to, make a difference this summer, please go ahead and find our jobs at smash.org, and you'll see all our job postings. We're looking for facilitators for all of our STEM courses and even our non-STEM courses as well.
Alicia Puri is the Regional Program Director of West Coast for SMASH. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're going to stick with science, but we're heading to the stars and beyond. Happening this week, the Lyrids, one of the oldest known meteor showers, is peaking across our skies. Lyrids can surprise watchers with as many as 100 meteors seen per hour, and the most impressive sightings have been recorded as early as 1803. William Cook is NASA's meteoroid Environment Program Manager, and he is joining us this morning, and we're just really excited to learn more and hopefully view the Lyrids ourselves. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Oh, doing fantastic, and really looking forward to ending the show with this. Can you just kind of explain for those who don't know, what is the Lyrid meteor shower, and because it's currently peaking this week?
Right. So a meteor shower occurs when the Earth, as it moves about the sun, runs into a trail of debris left behind by a comet or asteroid. So imagine this stream of space rocks, and as the Earth moves into its orbit, it might intersect and run into that stream. And when we hit that stream of space rocks, we get a meteor shower. And most meteor showers are produced by comets. In the case of the Lyrids, we're running into debris left behind by a comet called Thacher, Comet Thacher, which was discovered back in 1861. So we're running into this debris, and we run into it this time every year. So we run into the debris from Comet Thacher at this time every year around April 20th, we get the Lyrid meteor shower. And we call them the Lyrids because if you look up and see the meteors and you trace them back in the sky where they come from, they all originate from the constellation of Lyra.
Hmm.
And that's how meteor showers get their names. They're named after the constellation the meteors appear to come from. So Lyrids come from Lyra, Geminids from Gemini, and Perseids from Perseus. So that's how a meteor shower gets its name. So a little bit about meteor showers there.
You know, I got to take just a little pause because I just noticed your backdrop when talking about the Lyrid meteor shower. You got a lot of rockets behind you. You can help us visualize this for a radio show. It's quite impressive.
I've been a model rocketeer for 50 years, and you get a lot of rockets in that time.
Yeah, I'm looking at dozens behind you. Very impressive.
Yes. So the Lyrids are what we call a moderate meteor shower. They're not as impressive as the Perseids and the Geminids, which are the two biggest meteor showers of the year. But as you pointed out, they've been seen for a long time. The first recorded instance was by the Chinese in 687 BC. And we have other records from 15 BC. And then there were some monastery records from AD 582. So we've seen the Lyrids for a long time. And the interesting thing about when you see meteor showers in ancient records, they always say stars fell like rain, which is kind of appropriate for the meteor shower. For example, the Munk record from 582 says, at Soissons, we see the sky on fire. A rain of blood falls on Paris. So that was the description of the Lyrids in AD 582. And then if you go forward to the 1803 outburst you mentioned of the Lyrids, you find similar descriptions of stars falling like rain in the newspapers in the U.S. from New Hampshire to Virginia. So a meteor shower is very appropriate because people, when they describe them, always describe, make the analogy to rain. And the Lyrids, like I say, are normally a moderate strength shower. You can expect 10 meteors per hour. So if you go out at the peak time, which is, you know, just before dawn, you know, you'll see somewhere around a Lyrid every 5 to 10 minutes, depending on your sky condition. The bad thing about the Lyrids is that they're typically fairly faint. Hmm. So you're not going to see them from the suburbs or a city. You're going to need to find a place with a dark sky.
Okay. And pretty much look in any direction in that peak time overnight?
The best way to observe a meteor shower is to lie flat on your back and look straight up. Take in as much of the sky as you can see, because meteors can appear anywhere in the sky. Mm. No telescope, no binoculars. It's the easiest form of astronomy there is. Just use your eyes. So just lie flat on your back and look straight up.
Well, I understand.
And you'll see Lyrids. I'm sorry?
No, and that is great advice. That's very manageable for all of us, just laying on our back and taking in the night sky away from the lights of the suburbs and the city lights.
Yeah, the problem, though, nowadays is we have these little distractions called cell phones, and you don't want to look at your cell phone when you're meteor observing because the bright light of the cell phone screen will ruin your night vision.
Right.
So, you know, it's a time you put the cell phone away and enjoy Mother Nature, because if you look at that cell phone screen, you're not going to see many meteors, especially the faint ones.
Exactly. Put on Do Not Disturb or turn it off altogether. It's not going anywhere.
That's correct.
It can wait. Well, Bill, I understand that meteors, I mean, they're your wheelhouse, but, you know, this week NASA is celebrating just more historic milestones with the Mars Perseverance rover. Earlier this week, NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter became the first aircraft in history to be a powered, controlled flight on another planet, and the Mars Perseverance rover actually recorded that. I watched that. You know, I think that's just, if you can just kind of touch upon the significance in this time in space exploration at NASA.
Well, you know, one of the precursors to humans exploring is to send our robots out. And we're finding that these rovers and our robots are incredibly powerful. So, you know, I was terribly excited when Perseverance landed. I work at Marshall Space Flight Center, and JPL does Perseverance, right?
You know, JPL's in Southern California.
Right. So, you know... No association with the program, but like everybody else, I was glued to the news and the TV and when Perseverance touched down. And of course, when the helicopter made its first flight, I made a point to be sure I was awake to see that, right? Because like they say, it's kind of a Wright Brothers moment. It was the first time we flew an aerial vehicle on another planet, right? So that's something you do. So we have all these incredible robots that are now out there and exploring. And even in my field, right, when we had the little Mars rover Spirit and Opportunity, we used the camera data from one of those rovers to look for meteors in the Martian atmosphere, okay? So, you know, kind of interested to try meteor observing on Mars when you're not really there. So you could do some very exciting things. And, you know, it's a very exciting time to live as far as exploring the solar system is concerned.
And an emotional time, too, watching these accomplishments.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, the 7 minutes of terror they describe, you know, it really is. You feel your heart racing, your blood pounding, you're thinking, oh, let it work out, you know, and it did. The people at JPL are absolutely fabulous.
William Cook is NASA's Meteoroid Environment Program Manager. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you.
And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify included. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.